Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, April 23rd, 2015. Upper Nile state officials and civilians take refuge at a UN camp as sections of South Sudan army continue to fight for 2 days.
Currently, there's a fighting between Wulun and the SPLA. That is what is happening now. They attacked SPLM and the SPLM fought them back. And they are now chased to the riverside. They attacked the position of the SPLA.
And U.S. government donates an additional $16 million to help humanitarian work in South Sudan.
And that puts the total U.S. contribution to South Sudan since December 2013 over $1 billion. So obviously that is a humongous amount of money. And I think it underscores the commitment that the U.S. has to the country of South Sudan and particularly to the people of South Sudan.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The U.S. government has donated an additional $16 million to help humanitarian work in South Sudan. The director of the U.S. Office for Foreign Disaster Assistance, Jeremy Konendike, says with the new injection of aid, his government has contributed more than $1 billion for humanitarian assistance to South Sudan since the conflict started in 2013. He says the government of South Sudan and the warring parties have a huge task ahead of them. They need to restore peace so that aid money can be used for development.
The U.S. government is announcing another $16 million in emergency humanitarian assistance for South Sudan. And that puts the total U.S. contribution to South Sudan since December 2013 over $1 billion. So obviously that is a humongous amount of money. And I think it underscores the commitment that the U.S. has to the country of South Sudan and particularly to the people of South Sudan who have been affected by this conflict.
This is happening at a time when some people are perceiving sort of donor fatigue. Why is the U.S. still committing itself to helping the people of South Sudan?
There is a strong commitment, not only from the U.S., but I think a strong commitment from the major donors to ensuring that we don't see a catastrophic situation in South Sudan. We made a large effort in 2014 to ensure that South Sudan would not deteriorate into famine conditions. We're making a very large effort again this year to make sure that famine is again avoided. But I have to say, it is difficult to do that in the face of this conflict. And the biggest problem, the biggest challenge that South Sudan has on the humanitarian front is the fact that this conflict still remains unresolved. And while I wouldn't say there is fatigue, I would say there is frustration that donor countries are continuing to put in large sums of money while the parties to this conflict cannot resolve their differences. Mm-hmm. And so we're pressing very hard on the political front at the same time to strongly urge the fighting parties to end this conflict.
My understanding is that your office sent a team of people to South Sudan right after the conflict broke out in 2013. What are these people telling you about the humanitarian conditions of the people in South Sudan?
Yes, that's right. So after the conflict broke out in December 2013, we sent in one of our DART teams. That's a disaster assistance response team. And that is what we do for the most important, highest profile crises that we face in the world. What that team is telling me is that the situation remains extremely bad. Some of the concerns we had about food insecurity last year have gotten slightly better this year. The situation, the access has gotten a little bit better, and the pre-positioning of food for the rainy season this year has gone much better than it did last year. But the situation is still extremely, extremely bad, and the latest figures we have are that about 3 million people are now in a situation of serious food insecurity.
What are some of the challenges that the humanitarian workers are facing on the ground? Because I remember speaking to UN OCHA, and they talked about some aid workers unable to go to areas just because of their ethnic background, and some people have disappeared. What kind of news are you getting from humanitarian workers as far as security of NGO employees are concerned?
It's a very concerning situation. And this goes back to what I said a few moments ago about the fact that the NGOs and the UN agencies are very willing and very committed to doing what is needed, but they can only do what the security situation enables them to do. And so we are gravely concerned by some of the recent news that we've seen about the disappearance of several World Food Program staff, reports of an attack on an NGO convoy in Jonglei recently. You know, those are the sorts of incidents that are going to make the work of the humanitarians much, much, much harder. And so the warring parties have a major responsibility and an obligation to allow the humanitarians to work unimpeded. And when they're taking actions that impede the humanitarian effort, they are, you know, they are directly harming their own population, their own people, and they need to own that responsibility.
And it seems like the attention is all focused on people who are displaced internally, but there are also refugees who have gone to Uganda, Kenya, Ethiopia. Is this part of assistance geared towards these refugees?
This particular announcement of the $16 million is focused on South Sudan, so it's not it isn't going towards the refugees. But the total $1 billion in humanitarian assistance that the U.S. government has provided since the beginning of the crisis, a large proportion of that is supporting refugees. And so the U.S. continues to be very committed to supporting refugees outside the country as well.
That's Jeremy Konendike, the director of U.S. Office for Foreign Disaster Assistance at the USAID office. He was speaking to me in Washington. The South Sudan government is welcoming the new injection of funding from the United States. South Sudan's Undersecretary of Humanitarian Affairs, Clement Taban Dominic, says the funding will have a huge positive impact on the lives of South Sudanese.
The $16 million donation by the American government is a good news for the people of South Sudan. If they are donating this money towards the delivery of humanitarian assistance in South Sudan, I think they are making good contribution in saving the lives of the people who are displaced and the people in need.
But Dominic says the government wants to be able to track how the USAID funds are used.
What we will ask as a government is the partners who are receiving this money to be very transparent, sharing with us as a government how they are utilizing this funding. At the moment, I think we have no information of the NGOs that are receiving funding from the American government and how they are utilizing this funding in the country. For which type of project? Is it water, health, education, food sector, etc.?
Commenting on USAID's concern about access to the millions of people in need in South Sudan, Dominic says the government is trying to ensure the security not only of internal displaced persons or IDP, but also of the humanitarian aid workers who are trying to help them. The UN Humanitarian Coordinator for South Sudan, Toby Lancer, says international aid agencies and the United Nations are very transparent with what they do with aid money. Lancer also told Karen Zaivogo that aid groups are pulling out of towns in Upper Nile because of the deteriorating security situation.
All of the non-governmental organizations and all of the UN agencies agree that transparency is fundamental in our dealings, not only with the people whom we are here to serve, but also with our counterparts in key ministries. You know, whether it's the Ministry of Health or Education or Agriculture, it is important that aid agencies indicate to their corresponding line ministries why they're here, what they're planning on doing, the work that's going to be carried out. And I think that donor governments who provide money to aid agencies are very public about how much money they provide, which NGO or which UN agency is receiving the money. And indeed, the United Nations runs a website, and you couldn't be any more public than putting things on the internet. We run a website known as the Financial Tracking Service. And there, anyone, anywhere with access to the internet can see exactly which governments have given how much money to which aid agencies. So there's no question about that. And, you know, full transparency on those sorts of issues.
You're calling for a guarantee of freedom of movement for aid workers in South Sudan. Why is this? You've made this call before. Why are you repeating it today?
Well, I'm really speaking about very particular areas of the country. Just over the past couple of days, In one area of Upper Nile State, in Pagak, it has become more difficult for staff of non-governmental organizations to operate in what we consider a neutral and impartial and independent manner. And because of that, we have taken a decision that we don't take lightly. We've taken a decision that until the conditions are really in place for the aid organizations to work in the way that they have to, and that is to be neutral and impartial and independent, until those conditions are back in place, it's better for us just to withdraw temporarily. We have to make sure that wherever we're working, and in this particular case, it's Pagak in Upper Nile State, wherever we're working, we are able to conduct programs in a manner which is solely aimed at helping people in need. And so we're looking forward to get back there just as soon as we can to continue, because the levels of need in that area, as in other areas of the country, for example, there are other parts of Upper Nile State. There are refugees from Sudan who have come into Mabun County. There are difficulties, as we know, in and around Malakal and just north of there on the road to Melut. Great difficulties, problems as well, where people are suffering and non-governmental organizations and UN agencies want to work and can do so. If the basic principles are in place, and if we are able to listen to people and tailor our programs in accordance with their needs.
That was UN Coordinator for Humanitarian Affairs in South Sudan, Toby Lancer, with Karen Zaivogo by phone from Juba. And now we have some updates from Malakal. Upper Nile State officials and civilians have fled from Malakal town and are taking refuge at a UN camp outside the town. Upper Nile State's Information Acting Minister told South Sudan in Focus that forces loyal to former militia leader Major General Johnson Oluny have been fighting South Sudan Army since Tuesday morning. Another senior military officer who is loyal to Oluny says South Sudan Army in Malakal is now divided along tribal lines. Colonel Johannes Yor Ajak told me forces under the command of Oluny are now in control of Malakal town. South Sudan military spokesman Colonel Philip Aguer says the situation in Malakal is unclear. South Sudan in Focus will continue to monitor the situation in Malakal. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we look at the practice of FGM in Western Bahr al-Ghazal State. That story is coming up next.
On Thursday, April 30th, VOA hosts a town hall-style meeting to discuss the South Sudan peace process. Moderator John Tanza and VOA's panel of guests will discuss what has been the role of the media, the involvement of the international community, how the peace process was conducted, and has it been inclusive enough? Join us for this event live on April 30th from 1800 to 1930 UTC by visiting voanews.com/South Sudan and clicking on the live web link. We welcome your participation with comments and questions. Email us at southsudan@voanews.com or you can tweet at VOA South Sudan.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how do you deal with conflicts with your friends and family?
When I have conflicts with my friends, we speak out what's on our mind. Why are you angry? Why are you having problems with me? What do you think I should do to correct?
In dealing with a conflict between my friends and family or other people, I try to understand them from their point of view. And after I have understood them, I try also to bring out my point for them to also understand where I'm coming from.
with friends, I just have to have patience and then organize how you resolve the problem. With my family, I think I have to be humble of them because I know that I can't be top of them of whatever I've done. Maybe I'm long, maybe they're long, but I just have to understand them what they're saying and I have to be humble, then I should solve the problem.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Even as fighting continues in South Sudan and more people are facing hunger, the government has announced that it is allocating 34 million South Sudanese pounds for Independence Day celebration in July. Civil society activists say the money should be spent on something that will do more to help the millions of people who are living in dire conditions. Mungome Debs Rakarinj files this report from Juba.
Merekaje Lona is the Secretary General of the South Sudan Domestic Election Monitoring and Observation Program. She says she was shocked when she heard how much money the government planned to spend to mark the country's fourth anniversary of independence on July 9th.
Why are you talking about such a huge amount of money for independence celebration while South Sudanese are dying of hunger, while South Sudanese are not having even paracetamol in the hospitals?
Lona says it is hypocritical to allocate millions for celebrations while some civil servants have gone for months without being paid. Lona says instead of planning a big party, officials should be looking into how to share the benefits of South Sudan's hard-fought independence with ordinary citizens. South Sudan has seen little in the way of development since it became the world's newest nation in 2011 after seceding from Sudan. Barely 2 years after independence, the country plunged into a new conflict that has claimed more than 10,000 lives, displaced millions, and pushed the economy to the edge of disaster.
The pound is weakening very fast, and the market is becoming unbearable for a common citizen. Getting food is a problem. So it really doesn't go well with citizens to hear about such amount of money being budgeted for celebration. And it doesn't mean that this celebration is going to bring peace to South Sudan. It doesn't mean that the celebration is going to avert the famine that the country is almost experiencing.
Edmund Yakani, the executive director of Community for Empowerment for Progress Organization, or CEPO, is even more blunt about his opinion of this year's Independence Day budget.
This real unrealistic one that we celebrate independence with such cost of money while our communities are dying on daily basis in need of humanitarian assistance, which is less than that. At least if they can spend $1 million or $2 million, that's enough.
Yakani says the government should spend the money on improving infrastructure in states that have been hard hit by the crisis. He says fixes to roads, the healthcare system, and other areas are needed to improve humanitarian access to these areas. Another civil society activist who requested anonymity because he fears his organization will be victimized wonders why the government plans to get £34 million or $10 million at the official exchange rate for the Independence Day party. The activist notes that South Sudan already has a huge budget deficit.
The country is spending £900 million and earning £600 million, which absolutely makes no sense, which means that this 10 million is basically debt. Is that the best way of spending borrowed money in this in a scenario such as this, where we have over a million of our citizens that are internally displaced, and we have over a million equally that cannot participate in this celebration because they are refugees in other countries?
The National Assembly last month gave the government the go-ahead to negotiate a $500 million loan from the Qatar National Bank. The Global Witness NGO has said the proposed loan carries a high interest rate that would require South Sudan to pay Qatar $781 million over 7 years if it is approved. Global Witness says South Sudan simply does not have that kind of money. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinj in Juba.
In Western Bahr al-Ghazal State, doctors say cases of female genital mutilation, or FGM, are sharply down. but they warn there should be no let-up in the fight to end FGM until no more girls are forced to undergo the painful and damaging practice. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from WOW.
Health advocates say female genital mutilation, also known as female circumcision, has harmed many women and girls in Raja County. They say they hear frequently of cases of FGM that result in women spending their entire lives in pain. One 29-year-old survivor of FGM, who asked to remain anonymous, said she was mutilated at the age 7. She grew up in the home of her aunt, who happened to be a Muslim. At such a young age, she says, she had no choice but to submit to the will of her guidance.
I was still young and I couldn't say no. My aunts took me and did the circumcision. If I had been able to talk to them, I would not have allowed them to circumcise me.
This FGM survivor says the trauma of the ritual still lingers. She says all three of her children had to be delivered under close medical supervision because of difficulties she faced in during childbirth. Dr. Yasir Biajo is the Raja County Hospital Medical Director. He says FGM can result in complications during delivery, which can result in the death of either the infant or the mother, or both.
As you know, during the delivery, the vagina will have to dilate up to 8 centimeters, and then the child will come out normally, side effect. But with this circumcision, they will tie the open, they will suture it, and then the lady will come to us with obstructed labor. If it is not handled well by a skilled birth attendant or a doctor, it's going to have to be a big complication. We may lose the child, or we may lose even the woman.
Biajo says Raja County Hospital has been treating patients with female genital mutilation related complications since the 1970s. He says the number of cases of women suffering the consequences of female genital mutilation is down significantly, but the practice has not been completely eradicated.
Still, some families, they are practicing it. If you can count those who are aging 20-something, those who are born in 1980s, 1970s, any female who comes with this age 20-something, we expect that they should have this female genital mutilation. Frequently, in a month, we can have 4 or 5 cases.
Monica Ilario, a civil society activist in WOW, says there needs to be more discussion between health providers, local authorities, and women's groups about female genital mutilation. Ilario said the practice must be brought to an end once and for all. But she says as long as people refuse to acknowledge that female genital mutilation occurs and do not identify perpetrators so that they can be punished for their actions, female genital mutilation will continue behind closed doors.
This thing really is dangerous for me. For us women, we have to stand to fight for the rights for other women. Because if we don't stand strongly after their rights, they will still face this problem. So it is our role now for those women who knows their rights to fight for the rights of the rest, that this thing is not good.
The United Nations Children's Fund said in a report released in 2013 that female genital mutilation is generally thought not to be practiced in South Sudan. Raja County Commissioner Maradoma James Benjamin has denied that FGM is still carried out in Raja County.
All traditional birth attendants who used to circumcise girls have stopped, and all their tools have been confiscated. These days, it is only older women who suffer the consequences of female genital mutilation during childbirth.
Last year, authorities in Western Baal Ghazal's state Ministry of Health said they were waiting for approval from the State Assembly's Health Committee to officially address the issue of female genital mutilation. For VOA, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio, reporting in WOW.
Last but not least, today is World English Language Learning Day. English is South Sudan's official language, but not everyone speaks it. So officials are taking steps to change that. Waki Simon Wudu visited an English language class for adults in the capital, Juba, and filed this report.
Our work of today is about how to use the word am, is, or are. Okay?
We say Lobajo Raymond is standing in front of a classroom of students ranging in age from 14 to 60 at Epata Primary School in Juba. Students are here to learn South Sudan's official language, English.
I think we have over 300. We have over 300 from level 1 up to level 4. So in my class, that is a level 1B, I have around 46 learners.
The English language course Raymond is teaching is part of the government's Accelerated Literacy Program, or ALP. ALP was launched by the Ministry of Education to improve the literacy rate among adults in the country. Level 1B learners are complete beginners of English, Raymond explains. He says if they perform well, they will be promoted to Level 1A. Raymond learned English as a child. He grew up as a refugee from the two-decade civil war in what was then unified Sudan.
I learned my English when we were in exile in Uganda. You know, I was taken very young, so I joined my primary one there. And you know, Uganda is a country that learn in English, so I got that chance to learn in English.
But Raymond is a minority in South Sudan. There are no recent government statistics or data from 8 agencies that show how many South Sudanese can read and write in English. But the World Bank says only 27% of South Sudanese aged 15 years and above can read and write at all. Even South Sudanese who have gone to secondary school and have higher education diploma are for the most part unable to speak English because when they were in school, the main language of instruction was Arabic. But in South Sudan today, not being able to speak English makes it difficult to get a good job with an NGO or international company. Mayak Mabil Ajak recognizes that fact. At 52, he is one of the older students in Raymond's class. Ajak says he would have liked to learn English when he was young, but the civil war prevented him from doing so. But he says he does not think he is too old to learn English now. He says his life will be simpler once he has mastered the English language.
I learned because here in our new nation, everything by English. If you like to buy something in the shop, if you cannot know to speak English, you cannot get something. What do you want?
South Sudan started developing its education policy in earnest in 2011 after independence from Sudan. That same year, the government decided that English would be the official language of the new nation. Moses Madeng Marial is the Director of National Languages at the Ministry of Education. Marial says the government's education policy stipulates that pupils from primary 1 to 3 should be taught in both their tribal dialect and English.
All indigenous languages are nationalized. You start from P1 up to P3, all the medium instruction will be mother tongue. While English is taught in the oral, after that writing is started in P3, and then when they reach P4, they drop mother tongue and will come as a subject from P4 up to higher level of education, up to university.
Marial says the ministry plans to pace out the teaching of Arabic in schools by the end of the year.
Those who were learning Arabic in secondary school and part of university are being phased out. Now, this is the last year that those who were doing Arabic are being phased out in secondary school and are going even university. So English will be the official language as a medium of instruction in the higher education and in secondary school.
Marial says students will still be able to learn other languages besides English as an elective subject in university. He says the Education Ministry is partnering with several aid agencies such as UNICEF and with the British Council to reinforce efforts in teaching English and reduce illiteracy in the country. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
And that report by Wudu from Juba brings us to the end of our show for this Thursday. We thank you for joining us, and please remember to join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.